Okay, good evening. We've been working really hard the last couple of weeks with halakha, so tonight there's no halakha. Tonight we're just pure Agadah, we're just reading a story, which is the famous story of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. One program note is they have just released all of the Koran Talmud English translation online. And I used to use the Sansino, which was written in like the 20s. So the English is a lot easier, I think, to read now. But you're the audience. If you like it, we'll keep it. If you don't, we'll change on that. So what this consists of is...
I can't see. I think he's coming in through the
camera. The other way. So what this consists of is...
He's out of patrol.
There are four interwoven stories, of which you all know the end, which you don't think so now, but you will. Don't look ahead.
There's one in every crowd.
And these stories, they're actually in four different places, in three collections of Midrash and in the Babylonian Talmud. So the stories were probably all independent at one time or another, but they were woven together, or as they like to say in the scholarly world, redacted into a whole. And I think it's very skillfully done, and you'll see how that works. And this is a story in chronological order. The original is partly in Hebrew and partly in Aramaic, but of course we're reading it all in English. I'll start reading, but let's go around tonight because there's a lot to read. And I'll just stop when...
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt you. Aramaic, that comes from... Babylonia?
Aramaic, yeah. That was kind of the language of the whole world spoke pretty much for a couple hundred years until around the time of year zero. We got another. So it's kind of like Old English to Modern English is Aramaic to Hebrew. But you won't see any of that. Do we?
But still, I guess
no one can go around the place is down there. Okay, so I was saying we're going to differentiate a lot of integrals tonight. Add 17 to the answer. Now, just you have enough room? Wait. Everyone, put your hands up. I'm going to move the table.
Thank you. It's a miracle. Take a deep breath.
Thank you.
Okay, so let's start off. This is the prelude. Rabbi Yochanan said, "What is the meaning of that which is written? Happy is the man who fears always, but he who hardens his heart shall fall into mischief." The Gemara explains, Jerusalem was destroyed on account of Kamsa and Bar Kamsa. So, it's ironic, it's how can a dispute lead to the destruction of God's holy city, Jerusalem. And that's where we'll find out. So why don't we start reading with you, dear, and I'll interrupt as necessary. And Aaron, always feel free to interrupt for any question, comment.
This is all Gemara, correct?
This is all from the Talmud, yes. It's all Agadah.
I'm going to start with a question.
What?
Doesn't Bar Kamsa mean son of Kamsa?
Yes.
So is this a father and son thing, or they just don't say?
No, it's just another title. It was also used in Aramaic world. You could be Bar so and so.
Right. Okay. Because I always thought that Bar was.
I guess it's somebody who's the same as the enemy's father.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Actually, it's relevant. It's relevant right away. So. Okay. So I'll read the first paragraph. You hold up.
Okay.
This is as there was a certain man whose friend was named Kamsa and whose enemy was named Bar Kamsa. He once made a large feast and said to his servant, "Go bring me my friend Kamsa." The servant went and mistakenly brought him his enemy, Bar Kamsa. So, the names. So the names are interesting. Kamsa in Aramaic means locust. So this is like locust versus son of locust, which is supposed to make you think, well, it's not supposed to make you think because they didn't know. It resonates with Tweedledum and Tweedledee, is what they're kind of saying. Now, so on one hand, it's kind of playful, On the other hand, it's going to be, as you'll see, very destructive. And a locust is a small but very destructive pest, something that brings starvation and death, which are the cheery themes of this story we're going to read. And there's also a sense that you're at a feast and locusts are coming, right? Locusts strip bare everything, and they don't know that they're coming.
Is this presented in the Talmud, I'm sorry,
yeah,
as an allegory, or is it supposed to be, from the Talmud's perspective, historical? Or is it just not known?
I don't know. It's a good, I would say it's probably not, because as you'll see, some of the pieces we'll read are clearly not historical, like when Nero converts to Judaism, that Nero. All right, Judy, why don't you stop? The man who was hosting.
The man who was hosting the feast came and found Bar Kamsa sitting at the feast. The host said to Bar Kamsa, "That man is the enemy of that man. That is, you are my enemy. What do you want here? Arise and leave." Bar Kamsa said to him, "Since I have already come, let me stay, and I will give you money for whatever I eat and drink. Just do not embarrass me by sending me out."
Keep going.
The host said to him, "No, you must leave." Bar Kamsa said to him, "I will give you money for half of the feast. Just do not send me away." The host said to him, "No, you must leave." Bar Kamsa then said to him, "I will give you money for the entire feast. Just let me stay." The host said to him, "No, you must leave." Finally, the host took Bar Kamsa by his hand, stood him up, and took him out.
One more.
After having been cast out from the feast, Bar Kamsa said to himself, "Since the sages were sitting there and did not protest the actions of the host, although they saw how he humiliated me, learn from it that they were content with what he did."
Stop. Okay. Anyone see anything odd in that last sentence?
The sages didn't protest the ill treatment.
But where did they come from?
They weren't in the story until now.
They weren't. That's exactly the point. You would have thought the story would have been written, "The man held a feast and invited the sages." Dot, dot, dot. You don't even know that they were there until this guy's thrown out and complaining about it. So It's an odd thing to have in that way. Okay, continue, please.
"I will therefore go and inform against them to the king. He went and said to the emperor, 'The Jews have rebelled against you.' The emperor said to him, 'Who says that this is the case?' Bar Kamsa said to him, 'Go and test them. Send them an offering to be brought in honor of the government and see whether they will sacrifice it.'"
Okay. So we now know the rabbis were there. And we also know the rabbis have witnessed the public humiliation of Bar Kamsa.
Who the host thought he was expelling Kamsa.
No, the host knew it was Bar Kamsa.
The servant got the wrong person.
It was the servant that got the wrong person.
The servant got it wrong. And when the host recognized it was the wrong man, he threw him out of the party, even though he said, "Please don't embarrass me, I'll pay for everything, blah, blah, blah."
He actually stood him up and walked him out.
Yes, he stood him up and walked him out. So the rabbi saw this, right? And they didn't do anything. What does this mean? It's a dual question. What should the rabbis have done? What could the rabbis have done? And does this mean the rabbis approve of the thing they're witnessing?
And what does it have to do with the emperor?
Well, we'll get there, but
the rabbis should have intervened.
And done what?
Well, the man clearly said he would be humiliated to be chased out like that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's something that you shouldn't allow to happen. So they should have pulled the host aside and said, "You can't humiliate a man like that."
Okay, understand there's no right or wrong answers here tonight. This is a story, and we're just going to talk about how it hits us. But I would retort with, is it any of their business?
Absolutely.
So, put yourself in that place. If you were at a party of a friend, and the friend did something embarrassing, I don't know, he hit his kid, would you say something? Would you leave? And I don't mean used to. As much as I'd like to know your personal answer. No.
It says you should reproach your neighbor.
Uh-huh.
Okay. I mean, that's something that the sages teach. So, when they see the opportunity to, reproach your neighbor for doing something, humiliating a person, where they equate that to homicide in the Talmud.
Mm-hmm.
So how could they allow that to happen?
But what if they didn't know that was happening? Because if this was a relatively quiet conversation, if Steve and I are talking at this end of the table, you may not be able to hear what we're saying. And even if he was, let's say, getting red in the face, maybe he was getting sick.
Well,
I mean, other people at the dinner don't necessarily know the conversation that's going on. There could have been a legitimate reason for him taking out.
But the text does say the sages were sitting and did not protest.
No, it
but
also
it doesn't say
says
that they heard it.
They saw,
but they didn't. But they didn't. Well, it doesn't say that they heard it.
Only Bar Kamsa says that.
But remember, it's like you and Steve having a conversation. All of a sudden, Lauren standing up and saying, "Steve, take him by the hand, say get out." Everybody saw him being thrown out.
Yeah, and presumably they would also know they were enemies.
But and supposedly Bar Kamsa was the enemy.
I mean, he was this guy's enemy. He wasn't an enemy. I mean, it was just he didn't like him. The enemies list.
They weren't friends.
It also doesn't say why he came.
He came because he got an
invitation, but maybe.
Maybe he thought the guy was making up to him. On the other hand, maybe the guy, the host, was concocting a scheme to further humiliate his enemy. No, but it says it's an accident, so I take that back.
The servant clearly made the mistake.
So, here's another question. Is it more or less worse because they're rabbis and not just regular people?
I think it's worse. I mean, they're supposed to be the ones who set the stage. They set the example.
So,
because this is really something that's intricate halakha.
There's no halakha.
Well,
that's not true either.
You wouldn't expect a rabbi would necessarily know, not to humiliate someone, just something that is known in general. So I don't know that the rabbis would know any more about that or have any other.
No, but you can still expect them to be more mishlatite.
Right.
Than everybody else.
Well, I think that's the expectation. The sages would. And they had the authority. I mean, they were the authority in the community.
So what could they have done?
They could have pulled him aside and said, look, as long as
him
he's here...
Him as the host.
Yes. As long as he's here, you really need to let him stay.
Right. Or what
or
else?
Just,
they could have gotten up and walked out with him.
Right. So I think those are the two actions they could have done. Either personally protest to the host or leave in sympathy.
Right.
Okay. So we're going to go on from there. So Bar Kamsa is furious and he goes to the emperor... Right? You read it up till sacrifice. Or did you?
Sacrifice.
So you said we're going to get to the connection here? Because in that paragraph, I don't see any connection.
That's just the start here.
Because it says the Jews have rebelled against you. What does that have?
To the emperor.
Yeah.
Okay.
He said to the emperor Jews have rebelled against you.
He's seeking revenge.
What proof does he have that the Jews have rebelled against
him? Oh, no, he's made it up.
Oh, he's made it up, okay.
He just wants to cause trouble now.
And the emperor even says, what are you talking about?
I mean, you can begin to see how the personal slight is now going to wind up in the destruction of Jerusalem. Because the emperor is involved. When the emperor is involved, it's never good. But as long as we're here, I mean, just keep this in mind. There are a couple themes that we're going to see, but I think the biggest theme is probably... this whole question of moral action. What do I do when I see things are wrong? I have to weigh, always in life, the alternatives, what's more harmful, what's least harmful, and so on. Okay, so go and test them, right? Or is that where we stop?
No, sacrifice.
Oh, we'll sacrifice it. Okay, so he says, Let's test the Jews. Michelle, why don't you pick up?
The emperor went and sent with him a choice 3-year-old calf. While Bar Kamsa was coming with the calf to the temple, he made a blemish on the calf's upper lip. And some say he made the blemish on its eyelids, a place where, according to us, halakha, it is a blemish. But according to them, Gentiles, it is not a blemish. Therefore, when Bar Kamsa brought the animal to the temple, the priests would not sacrifice it on the altar since it was blemished. But they also could not explain this satisfactorily to the Gentile authorities, who did not consider it to be blemished. Oh, a sneaky little guy there.
Yes, it is a sneaky little thing.
Sneaky little guy, boy.
Okay, so is everyone following what's going on here, why this is a test.
Mm-hmm.
Because the emperor sends a sacrifice. Jews have rules about what's a proper sacrifice and what's not. We may need more M&Ms.
Bad night.
Never happened. That's a good night, Michelle. So Jews have rules about what's a proper sacrifice, and one of those rules is the animal has to be perfect. It can't have any sores or cuts or blemishes or, you know, missing a limb or anything like that. The Gentile sacrifice rules are not as stringent, so you can get away with a blemished sacrifice. So by Bar Kamsa gets presumably an unblemished sacrifice, and he cuts his lip because he knows that's acceptable to the Gentiles, but not acceptable to the Jews.
Interesting, yeah. He would know that.
And yeah, we're to assume that Bar Kamsa is not Jewish.
No, we assume he is Jewish.
If he is Jewish, then how can he say to the emperor what he does, that it's the Jews, and not be including himself?
Because he's an angry man. Well, clearly he knows the laws of sacrifices.
Right.
So... he knows what he's testing. Okay.
You know, that's an ingratiating thing to the emperor. Right. Other Jews,
yeah. Like that's never happened before. Right.
Okay, please keep going, Michelle.
The blemish notwithstanding, the sages thought to sacrifice the animal as an offering due to the imperative to maintain peace with the government. Rabbis accommodated.
Well, I'll stop you for a second. Okay. All right, so realize again, the sages are the rabbis. It's the same group. And they now have a dilemma. They know that if they don't sacrifice this animal, the emperor's going to hear about it and they're in trouble. On the other hand, they know that the Jews are going to be upset if they sacrifice a blemished animal. So once again, they're in that moral situation of what do I do? But the stakes will go higher. Please.
Rabbi Zakaria ben Avkalos,
a nice Greek name,
said to them, if the priests do that, people will say that blemished animals may be sacrificed as offerings on the altar. The sages said, if we do not sacrifice it, then we must prevent Bar Kamsa from reporting this to the emperor. The sages thought to kill him, so that he would not go and speak against them. Rabbi Zakaria said to them, if you kill him, people will say that one who makes a blemish on sacrificial animals is to be killed. As a result, they did nothing. Bar Kamsa's slander was accepted by the authorities, and consequently, the war between the Jews and the Romans began. Rabbi Yohanan said...
All right, no, stop there.
Okay.
So first of all, the question was, make the sacrifice or not make the sacrifice. And then that elevates into kill Bar Kamsa or make the sacrifice. Because if they kill him, then they don't have to make the sacrifice. So it's escalated even higher. And what do? Just like in the story of the party,
nothing. They
do nothing. Okay, so I call these two things scene one and scene two. In scene one, the rabbis fail as moral leaders. They stand by as the host rejects Bar Kamsa's offering, right? He's offering to pay for the party, and they reject that. In scene two, they fail as community leaders, rejecting Rome's offering as Bar Kamsa watches. Now, here's the key thing. Why do they reject Rome's offer? What's the explanation given in here?
Because they don't want to sacrifice a blemished animal on the altar.
Well...
they want people to think it's acceptable to love them.
Right.
How many times, if you look through here, I didn't count it, the phrase is, what will people say? And what's pointed out here is, what are they specifically not asking? What
What's
is
right?
The halakha?
Right.
What is right? But what is right is, what is the halakha? So they're failing in an even bigger way, because what they're doing is not even standing by a principle, but they're kind of standing by public opinion. So they're really blowing it, is what it's coming out to. Okay, and also the tension is building, right? It goes from the party to the sacrifice to killing Bar Kamsa. And it's ratcheting up. That's part of the storytelling. Now, please, the next sentence.
Rabbi Yohanan says, the excessive humility of Rabbi Zakaria ben Avkalos destroyed our temple, burned our sanctuary, and exiled us from our land.
Okay, so here we have kind of a real abrupt break in the story, where all of a sudden Rabbi Yochanan, who led off, remember, with the psalm, now comes in with another saying where he's blaming excessive humility, and I want to talk about that for a moment. First of all, I think by breaking the story with this sentence, it's a literary device that says to us, that moment has now come and gone. The train's running down the track, we don't have the brake, something's going to happen, we're going to find out what it is, you pass the point of decision. Now, excessive humility here in the Hebrew is anvetanut, and generally that's a positive thing. The root is anav, and the famous saying is Moses was the most humble of all men. That's the word that's used. So in a positive sense, it means humility, modesty, or patience. But there's a flip side to this, which now measures the theme of action in action. The negative side of this is meekness is the word that was used in English. And I also wrote down a note that I would say wimpiness. Right? It's a good thing to be humble, but can you be too humble to the point where you're a wimp? And I think that's what Rabbi Yochanan is saying in this sentence. And this is kind of the main theme of the story. And this reflects back now to the very opening line of the psalm, of the verse here, which is, happy is the man who fears always, but he who hardens his heart shall fall into mischief. He seems to be saying that fear is good, but when you harden yourself to other people's misfortunes, you will encounter misfortune. That's the foreshadowing. So the rabbis, in a sense, are the model of this. They're extremely cautious because they're afraid their actions will be misconstrued by other people. But by doing so, they harden their own hearts against the consequences of their actions.
Is that hardening, or is it more like stubbornness? In other words, they were very stubborn and stiff-necked, I think is the term we use, in their saying, we can't do it.
I don't get the sense from reading this. Stiff-necked I won't say a positive quality, it would be
right.
An active quality. I'm going to oppose you versus I'm going to pretend you don't exist.
Right. They did take action by saying no.
But they also couldn't.
They said no, we can't, you know, they said no, you cannot sacrifice this animal. That was an action. It's really not an inaction. They didn't just stand by passively.
They also could have killed Bar-Kokhba.
Well,
yeah.
That's a bit extreme.
Hold on.
It is a bit extreme, yeah. But it was present.
They came up with it as an option. Yeah, they debated it.
By the way, I don't think we know what they did, right? The text only says, as a result, they did nothing. So I don't. That's a good question. This is like the lady or the tiger. Did they do the sacrifice in the end, or did they not do the sacrifice?
Well, they did not do the sacrifice.
It sounds like they didn't. But since Bar Kokhba is still alive, then Bar Kamsa.
And Bar Kamsa's slander was accepted by the authorities, which implies they didn't do the sacrifice.
And that he told.
Yeah.
That they
okay.
Didn't
you're
do
right.
It.
You're right. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, no, because slander means that it's not true.
Well, the author
knows that it's not true, but it says it was accepted by the authorities.
No, it says Bar-Kokhba's slander.
Right.
So that means Bar-Kokhba said something that was not
right,
true.
Right, that's what he did before. The thing that he said that wasn't true was the fact that the Jews were
rebelling
against the
right.
emperor, and he was using this sacrifice
as
proof of his lie.
Yeah.
I thought it to mean that Bar-Kokhba said slandered, and they had sacrificed, but he said they didn't.
No, I think
Michelle is right.
His original slander was they're going to rebel, and this is proof of that.
So it looks like that is what happened.
And he defouled the calf on the way to the sacrifice.
I first learned this lesson as a cautionary tale about being too narrow and strict in your interpretations and readings.
Which I think is a valid way to read this.
Yes.
And
they were so worried about how somebody might perceive the...
Yeah.
Right, and again, to go to the end, themes of this is, which is interesting because it's the Talmud subverting itself in a way. They're saying, you know what, would be better off if you would have just sacrificed the animal and forgot the rules today.
Well, yeah, but the Talmud is full of that, where they kind of go flip flop on issues, and sometimes they don't make a determination on an issue because they want somebody else. I mean, we were talking last week when I was talking about the afterlife.
Mm-hmm.
And the one rabbi says, "Oh, we'll let them decide when it happens. You know, when Messiah comes, we'll decide what the halacha will be."
But it's a little different, right? Because in this case, inaction leads to consequences.
Yes.
And action leads to consequences. And again, I think the point of this is sometimes you have to choose.
See, and I always question, you know, when they say, what would the people say? Who would know? I mean, they're up on the altar. The people are all down, you know, in the valley.
I guess they know if the smoke's not coming up, that they're going to do a sacrifice.
Well, yeah, I mean, seriously, I mean, the priest.
No, but if they had sacrificed the one with a blemish, who would know? Known?
Well, but it is. I mean, in the temple forecourt, there's that whole.
Right. But
what's the word?
Plaza. They could have. You know,
done a super secret sacrifice, and no one would know.
Double secret.
My question is, why is it the excessive humility of Rabbi Ben Zakaria, and not the sages? The sages, as a group, decided not to do the sacrifice.
Well, somehow he got in the story, and he seems to be the answer man. Right? Twice it says he said to them, "If you do this, people will say."
He's the one who made the ruling.
So he's just a figurehead, I guess.
Yeah. He's the one who made the ruling. The sages could have overridden him, or at least debated him to the point.
So he's the scapegoat here.
But it's still unclear to me what Rabbi Yochanan wanted them to do. In other words, he's upset that Rabbi Zakaria prevented them from doing something, but I'm not sure which one.
I think it's killing Bar Kamsa. I think that's what he says they should have done. But at minimum, should have done the sacrifice.
But you think Rabbi Yohanan is saying you should have killed Bar Kokhba?
Yeah, I think so.
Bar Kamsa, rather?
All right, part two. Lawrence, take up the reading, please.
Roman authorities then sent Nero Caesar against the Jews.
Okay, stop here. Nero Caesar, so Caesar here is a title. Think of it as like doctor.
Michelle.
But in the
Pineapple.
They know his name isn't Nero Caesar. That's...
Well,
how
like
he's
Julius.
Addressed. Pardon me?
But just like Julius Caesar.
Yeah.
Actually, last night on Jeopardy, it was somebody answered Caesar, and he goes, which one?
Yes, I saw that.
That's a good question.
Okay, continue, please.
When he came to Jerusalem, he wished to test his fate. He shot an arrow to the east, and the arrow came and fell in Jerusalem. He then shot another arrow to the west, and it also fell in Jerusalem. He shot an arrow in all four directions of the heavens, and each time the arrow fell in Jerusalem.
Go on.
Nero then conducted another test. He said to the child, "Tell me the verse that you learned today." He said to him as follows, "And I will lay my vengeance upon Edom by the hand of my people Israel." Nero said, "The Holy One, blessed be he, wishes to destroy this temple, and he wishes to wipe his hands with that man, with me. The Romans are associated with Edom, descendants of Esau. If I continue on this mission, I will eventually be punished for having served as God's agent to bring about the destruction." So he fled and became a convert,
and ultimately
Rabbi Meir descended from him.
Okay.
He knows an awful lot about Jewish law.
Yeah. Pretty impressive.
Rabbi Meir descended from Nero?
Okay, so what the text is telling you by that is he's the good guy. He did the right thing. In other words, it's very frequently you find in the Torah, da-da-da, and David was descended from them, like the story of Ruth.
The begots.
And the Mashiach will come from David's line. All that means... You did right. You did a good thing. So obviously the Roman authorities send Nero because of what they consider the revolt of the Jews, or to punish him. Mm-hmm. And Nero's a man on a mission, but there's an irony here in that Bar Kamsa thought that the rabbi's inaction meant their approval. And here... the emperor thinks that the rabbi's inaction represents disapproval. Just a little thing in there.
Where is their rabbinical inaction here?
About the sacrifice. That they didn't make the sacrifice. That was their inaction.
Right, but how is that related to this? I'm lost.
It's a contrast between the rabbi's inaction. both times the rabbis don't act.
Right, got that.
In the first case, Bar Kamsa thinks it means approval.
Right.
In the second case, the emperor thinks it means disapproval.
Okay.
So it's just a literary irony thing.
And what's the point of shooting the arrows?
Excellent question. So what is the point of shooting those arrows? So these are oracles. These are how, obviously it's a fanciful story because even if it were real, you shoot an arrow in this direction, that direction, it can't wind up in the same place. So it's an oracle. It's a sign of like, what's God telling me to do? And all the arrows rest in Jerusalem, means go to Jerusalem. The second thing with the child and the verse, if you remember that back from when we talked about the story of Acher, of Elisha ben Abuya, when it was a way the ancients used to tell the future. They would stop a school child and say, recite a Torah verse, and that verse would be the oracle for them, telling them what to do. So, and that's, of course, what happens here. Now, the verse is significant, as the text explains, because Edom was a country, but by the time of the Talmud, Edom came to mean Rome. And 1,000 years later, in the Talmud, Edom came to mean the Christians. So Edom is always the enemy, and Nero comes from the enemy. That being said, Nero is different than the rabbis again, because the Nero takes action, number one. He goes and does something immediately. And number two, relying on an oracle, in a sense, is like relying on God. Because after all, he's looking for a message from heaven, which is something that the rabbis didn't do. Right? The rabbis didn't care about that.
So what I don't understand about this, though, is
yes.
He says, okay, so God wants me to destroy, wants Rome to destroy Jerusalem.
Right.
But I can't be the one who does it. He's afraid of following God's commandment, and he's afraid of not following God's
exactly. commandment. Where have we seen that before? Right, it's not he's afraid of disobeying, not of following.
If he disobeys God, doesn't destroy Jerusalem, he's disobeying God.
Right.
Okay, but instead he runs away.
Or he's disobeying the emperor.
He pulls a Jonah. He runs away.
Exactly. Run away. Yes. Yes, that's exactly the point. And again, because Rabbi Meir DeCenzurim is telling him, you did good. You did the right thing. Okay. So let's continue.
The Roman authorities.
The Roman authorities. We'll go to Stu.
The Roman authorities then sent Vespasian Caesar against the Jews. He came and laid siege to Jerusalem for 3 years. Three wealthy people offered their assistance. One of them said to the leaders of the city, I will feed the residents with wheat and barley. And one of them said to the leaders of the city, I will provide the residents with wine, salt, and oil. And one of them said to the leaders of the city, I will supply the residents with wood. These three wealthy men had between them enough commodities to sustain the besieged for 21 years.
Okay, Now, the attack against Jerusalem by Vespasian is a historical event. So, I'm just saying that. I don't know that it occurred the way they said here. Please go on.
There were certain zealots among the people of Jerusalem. The sages said to them, let us go out and make peace with the Romans. But the zealots did not allow them to do this. The zealots said to the sages, let us go out and engage in battle against the Romans. But the sages said to them, you will not be successful. It would be better for you to wait until the siege is broken. In order to force the residents of the city to engage in battle, the zealots arose and burned down those storehouses of wheat and barley, and there was general famine.
And the destruction of stores is also historically a true thing, not necessarily the way it says here.
So we have rabbinic inaction again.
Okay, so we have rabbinic inaction again, exactly. And notice that two things. One is, there's this theme of food again. They're talking about all this food, the rabbis at a party with food, the sacrifice is food. It's tied in with the story.
But the rabbis really weren't inactive here. They were going to take action. They couldn't control the zealots.
Okay, but how did the zealots arise? The zealots arise because there was a vacuum of leadership.
Right.
Remember, the original story says that the rabbis were, first two parts,
The rabbis were
moral failures, mm-hmm. and then they were leadership failures.
Yeah, but the rabbis said, let's go make peace. let's go out
now,
and
the
make
zealots,
peace.
The zealots. No, the zealots said, let's make peace. The rabbi said, no. And then the zealots said,
No, the sages said peace.
The sages said, let's go to the, make peace with the Romans. The zealots did not allow them. So it's almost like the rabbi is wanting to do something. The zealots, there was a coup. And the zealots overthrew them, overthrew their authority.
Right. And interestingly, that backs that up. The word for zealots here is birioni. And birioni is really, it's almost an anagram of rabbi in Hebrew. And I think the text is trying to use that word to say, these are two sides of the same coin. The action side and the non-action side. So ultimately, you would say, who's at fault here? I think you would have to say the rabbis, not the zealots. I mean, the zealots shouldn't have burned the food down, perhaps. But the rabbis created the leadership vacuum. Part three, Marta. So this is story number three.
With regard to this famine, it is related that Martha ben Bakios was one of the wealthy women of Jerusalem. She sent out her agent and said to him, go bring me fine flour, no fine flour, but if there is ordinary flour.
Whoa, you skipped a line.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
By the time he went.
You never said it was reading about me.
You can pass on to the next person.
Go bring me fine flour. By the time he went, the fine flour was already sold. He came and said to her, there is no fine flour, but there is ordinary flour. She said to him, go then and bring me ordinary flour. By the time he went, the ordinary flour was also sold. He came back and said to her, there is no ordinary flour, but there is coarse flour. She said to him, go then and bring me coarse flour. By the time he went, the coarse flour was already sold. He came and said to her, there is no coarse flour, but there is barley flour. She said to him, then go and bring me barley flour. But once again, by the time he went, the barley flour was also sold. Shall I continue?
I'll just say two things here. First of all, this is like the Nero story. It's an interlude in the general action of the siege of Jerusalem. So why is it here? I think, one, it moves the story along. Two, I think it's in here to show you the effects of the famine, right? There is no food, and so they're searching for food. And this is almost fairy tale-like in the way it goes back and forth, back and forth. And, of course, it's a story, once again, about meekness, about wimpiness. The servant doesn't take action, and because of that, they starve. You know, I gave away the answer. All right, keep reading, and we'll more to talk about.
She had just removed her shoes, but she said, I will go out myself and see if I can find something to eat.
It's an interesting, yes, story.
She stepped on some dung, which stuck to her foot, and overcome by disgust, she died.
Wow,
yes.
Dramatic.
That woman's not having a good day.
But she was starving at the time she stepped on.
Yeah, right. That living in those times, that would have disgusted somebody so much that they died. I mean, that's some permadonna.
Okay, you're going to see another foot story. It's another sub-theme that runs through this. You can make of it what you will. I also think this story is an allusion back to the banquet, right, where Bar Kamsa offers to pay for the banquet and is denied. And here, Marta is willing to pay for food, but in effect, she's denied. So I think that's a common theme going through this. Okay.
So I continue, want to go to the next.
Go ahead. Yeah, I enjoy the mellifluous sounds of your voice.
Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai read concerning her a verse found in the section of the Torah listing the curses that will befall Israel. The tender and delicate woman among you who would not venture to set the sole of her foot upon the ground. It is further related that as she was dying, she took out all of her gold and silver and threw it in the marketplace. She said, why do I need this? And this is what is written. They shall cast their silver in the streets, and their gold shall be as an impure thing. The silver and their gold shall not be able to deliver them in the days of the wrath of the Lord. They shall not satisfy their souls, neither fill their bowels.
Okay.
All the good ones.
I knew you'd like the fun parts. Okay, this is the first time we hear in the story of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And his appearance here is not a coincidence. We didn't really need him to present these verses from Deuteronomy, which is what the rabbis are doing here. In this case, when I say the rabbis, I mean the rabbis of the Talmud, not the rabbis of the story. That they have a great quote connecting death and feet and gold. So they're putting all those things together, and they're tying it to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, because he's going to be in the story. Also, he's a parallel to Nero in that he's looking for Torah verses to tie to the events he's witnessing. And finally, the last verse about Ezekiel is just, I think the rabbi's adding a gloss in about comparing wealth to starvation. And I think that's...
It had nothing to do with stepping in a dunk.
Well, no, the foot one did. Well, okay, not so. The verse in Deuteronomy connects the feet. And... But no, you're right. That stands by itself. Never mind.
But what did she step in that killed her? Or that she died from?
Dung.
And if you can't fill your bowel because you have no food, therefore do you not have?
That's good. That's good. I like that. Okay. That is very good. Now we go on to part four. This is the end story. And this is a story that everyone knows to some degree. So
the sneaking out of...
Yes. So we go now to Aaron. Would you like to read?
Part 4, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Abba Zakkara was a leader of the Zealots of Jerusalem and a son of the sister of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai sent a message to him. Come to me in secret. He came, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to him, Until when will you do this and kill everyone through starvation? Abba Zakkara said to him, What can I do? For if I say something to them, they will kill me. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai said to him, Show me a method that I will be able to leave the city, and it is possible that through this there will be some small salvation.
Okay, so we've now come full circle. Bar Kamsa was forced to leave the party. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai can't leave the party. That's an irony. Also, the rabbis did nothing and stayed at the party, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai will do something and get to leave the party. Abba Zakkara is a name that is meaningful. Zakkara really means assassin. So this is like Father Assassin is his name, or Chief Assassin. And that's also an irony, because he's the Chief Assassin, yet he can't go against his own followers in negotiating a peace or getting the rabbi out of the city. Another thing to notice, what does Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai want? He just wants some small salvation. It's a very interesting phrase to be used there. The idea is he knows at this point he can't save everyone. So he just wants to save something small that comes out of this.
Meaning himself. I mean, that's kind of...
No, not himself. Not himself, and as we'll see in the end. And also... Well, no, let's... Aaron, go on and read the next one, please, and then we'll talk.
Rabbi Zakkara said to him, This is what you should do. Pretend to be sick and have everyone come and ask about your welfare, so that word will spread about your ailing condition. Afterward, bring something putrid and place it near you, so that people will say that you have died and are decomposing. And then have your students enter to bring you to burial, and let no one else come in so that the zealots not notice that you are still light, as the zealots know that a living person is lighter than a dead person.
Yes.
I'm a little confused as to who the zealots are.
The zealots are the anti-rabbi faction. that's running the show.
But then they would be in cahoots with the, wouldn't they be, they're against the Romans too, though.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
They're Jews. Who
they're historically
the Romans,
accurate.
They fought the Romans at every possible juncture.
These are the people also who were in Masada.
But they want the rest of the citizens to fight the Romans, so they figure if we make them starve, they'll fight.
There's
no
choice. Right. The Ainbray-Ross solution.
They were too small by themselves. They needed everybody to join them.
Historically, there are actually several of these factions, and they were all zealots, as opposed to the rabbis.
I thought that a dead person was lighter than a living person.
No, a dead person is heavier.
No.
Well,
no, they weigh the same.
Physically the same. But
they can't. But
there's a folk belief. Gone.
If somebody is lying on the ground, right, and you go to lift them, if they're alive, involuntarily they will do things to help lift themselves up, either moving their legs or their arms or whatever, so they feel like they're lighter than lifting a dead weight.
That's exactly right. That's the folk belief that dead people are heavier than living people. Now I was surprised. No, that's exactly right. I didn't know that either until I researched this.
But it isn't true.
Well, no, it seems true.
I understand that, but because it... The other thing also is that however much he weighs, I don't think that they would necessarily be able to tell a little weight from another.
No,
it doesn't
silly.
Matter, though. It's all allegorical.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just the way you tell a story. Okay, so things about this last paragraph, right? What were the rabbis always worried about? What will people say? Abba Sakara says twice, the Romans will say, they will say. More irony. And what will people say, by the way? They'll say Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai abandoned the temple, abandoned the city, the people. He collaborated with the chief assassin and with the Romans, evidently. I can't think of the word. Down the line. So I said before that Rabbi and Bironi were kind of two sides of the same coin. But now here they're merging, which is very interesting into the story. Renee, continue, please.
Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai did this. Rabbi Eliezer entered from one side and Rabbi Yehoshua from the other side to take him out. When they arrived at the entrance of the city on the inside, the guards who were of the faction of the zealots wanted to pierce him with their swords in order to ascertain that he was actually dead, as this was the common practice. Abba Sakara said to them, "The Romans will say that they pierce even their teacher." The guards then wanted at least to push him to see whether he was
still
alive.
That's the part I like.
In which case he would cry out on account of the pushing. Abba Sakara said to them, "They will say that they push even their teacher." The guards then opened the gate, and he was taken out.
Okay, I was one paragraph too short when I said the Romans will say, the people will say. So it comes out in that story.
Then Rabbanan Yochanan ben Zakkai reached the Roman camp. He said, "Greetings to you, the king. Greetings to you, the king." Vespasian said to him, "You are liable for two death penalties, one because I am not a king, and yet you call me a king, and furthermore, if I am a king, why didn't you come to me until now?" Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai said to him, "As for what you said about yourself, I am not a king. In truth, you are a king. If not now, then in the future. As if you are not a king, Jerusalem will not be handed over into your hand. As it is written, the Lebanon shall fall by the Mighty One. And the Mighty One means only a king, as it is written, and their Mighty One shall be of themselves, and their ruler shall precede them from the midst of them," indicating that the Mighty One parallels ruler, and Lebanon means only the temple, as it is stated, "That good mountain and the Lebanon." And as for what you said with your second comment, "If I am the king, why didn't you come to me until now?" There are zealots among us who did not allow us to do this.
Okay, so Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is now doing again the opposite of meekness. He's actually risking the death penalty twice. He doesn't worry about what the king's going to say to him. And unlike the other rabbis, he refers to scripture. He's quoting Torah here to Vespasian. So he's behaving unlike his predecessors. And the rest of it is, I think, pretty self-explanatory. Fran, okay. You want to jump in?
Sure. Understanding that Rabban Yohanan ben Zakkai was prepared to ask him not to destroy the temple, Vespasian said to him, if there is a barrel of honey and a snake is wrapped around it, wouldn't they break the barrel in order to kill the snake? In a similar fashion, I am forced to destroy the city of Jerusalem in order to kill the zealots. Barricaded within it, Rabban Yohanan ben Zakkai was silent and did not answer. In light of this, Rav Yosef later read the following verse about him, and some say that it was Rabbi Akiva who applied the verse to Rabban Yohanan ben Zakkai. I am the Lord. Who turns wise men backward and makes their knowledge foolish? As Rabban Yohanan ben Zakkai should have said the following to the Vespian in response, in such case we take tongs, remove the snake and kill it, and in this way we leave the barrel intact. So too, you should kill the rebels and leave the city as it is.
Okay, so, small part, snake, dracon, right? Sounds like an English word, dragon. It's probably where it comes from. So what's interesting here is that Yochanan ben Zakkai doesn't say anything. And the text tells us he was silent and did not answer. And they're trying to come up with verses to explain that. And I think it shows the text is ambivalent regarding him. At one point, he's doing the right thing. On the other hand, you know, it's too little too late. If he had acted 3 years ago, the city probably would have been saved. So he's a flawed hero, is what this comes out to be. And even up until today, as we'll... I already forgot the ending part about what he wants. Yeah, we'll see. It's a mixed bag. And also the whole parable of the barrel and the snake and the honey, I think also says that Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai is kind of a fool, which is what one of these verses says, because he should have known that there was a way to get the honey out of the barrel without harming the honey.
To kill the snake without harming the barrel.
Yeah, wasn't ben Zakkai a contemporary of Akiva?
He was about two generations earlier.
Because
this is in 70, and Akiva's around 130. Bar Kokhba, he's right. Akiva thought that's always my touch point. 70. Thought that Bar Kokhba. No, Bar Kokhba was in 132.
132, right. Okay.
So he thought Bar Kokhba was the Messiah. So that's how he always can date that.
So who is saying, I am the Lord?
That's just the text.
Oh, okay.
It's quoting Isaiah. All right, please go on, Fran.
Okay, in the meantime, as they were talking, a messenger arrived from Rome and said to him, rise, for the emperor has died, and the noblemen of Rome plan to appoint you as their leader and make you the next emperor. At that time, Vespasian was wearing only one shoe, and when he tried to put on the other one, it would knock him on his foot.
Okay, here's foot reference number two, Steve.
He then tried to remove the other shoe that he was already wearing, but it would not come off. He said, what is this? Should I continue?
Please do.
Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai said to him, be not distressed or troubled, for good tidings have reached you. As it is written, good tidings make the bone fat.
And that's why I'm always hearing good news.
And your feet have grown fatter out of joy and satisfaction. Vespasian said to him, but what is the remedy? What must I do in order to put on my shoe? Rabban Yohanan ben Zakkai said to him, have someone with whom you are displeased come and pass before you, as it is written, a broken spirit dries the bones. He did this, and the shoe went on his foot. Vespasian said to him, since you are so wise, why didn't you come to see me until now? Rabban Yohanan ben Zakkai said to him, But didn't I already tell you? Vaspin said to him, I also told you what I have to say.
Okay, so, right, the story of the shoe seems to be, if you're so smart that you can quote the Torah and fix my shoe, why couldn't you save your city? And again, Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai has no answer. And it turns, the shoe story for Vespasian is kind of humiliating, right? He's the king now, the emperor, and he can't put the shoe on his foot. But he turns it around and really humiliates Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. So he's still kind of a fool. Okay, some other motifs here is, once again, we have a messenger coming in with a critical announcement. Just like there are messengers / servants at the banquet, there are messenger servants at the story of Marta, and now we have another one putting on the shoes. Another thing that runs through these stories, and this, by the way, is when I say the stories are skillfully put together, you can see these themes run throughout these stories, and they kind of tie them together. And another irony is Bar Kamsa came uninvited into his enemy's domain, and he is humiliated. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai comes uninvited into his enemy's domain, and he is not humiliated, but he's humbled. And again, the failure to act causes hardship, but when you understand and cite Torah, that solves problems. It works. Okay, we've gone full circle. Back to you. Back to my favorite reader.
Vespasian then said to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, I will be going to Rome to accept my new position, and I will send someone else in my place to continue besieging the city and waging war against it. But before I leave, ask something of me that I can give you. Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai said to him, give me Yavna and its sages, and do not destroy it, and spare the dynasty of Rabban Gamliel, and do not destroy them, as they were rebels, and lastly, give me doctors to heal Rabbi Tzadok. Rav Yosef read the following verse about him, and some say that it was Rabbi Akiva who applied the verse to Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai. I am the Lord, who turns wise men backward and makes their knowledge foolish, as he should have said to them to leave the Jews alone this time. And
go ahead.
Okay. And why didn't Rabban Yochanan ben Zakkai make this request? He maintained that Vespasian might not do that much for him, and there would not be even a small amount of salvation. Therefore, he made only a modest request in the hope that he would receive at least that much.
Okay, so he gets to three wishes here. And his first one is to give him Yavne and his sages. So Yavne is a city, still exists, near Tel Aviv. And what he's asking for is to establish a yeshiva. Because Rabbi Yochanan Zakkai is thinking that Jerusalem gets wiped out, the Jews get wiped out, Torah gets wiped out, Jewish people are over. So he wants that small salvation. He wants to save the Torah and the sages who go along with it. That's the first request. The second one is Rabban Gamliel, the family of Rabbi Gamliel. Why? Because he is of a royal family, and the Messiah is eventually going to come from him. So once again, keep hope alive. That's another piece of the Jews. And the third one's a little bizarre, the doctors of Rabbi Tzadok. Rabbi Tzadok has been fasting for 40 years for the safety of the Jews.
Doesn't seem to be very effective.
Well, it does. He gets it in the end. He survives in the end.
Well, he does, but the rest
of them are. That's a curious thing that I really have no other explanation for.
They also quote the same Isaiah passage twice.
Because again, I think they're giving to Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai. And this is what I was saying, that in the end, is he a hero or a traitor, right? On one hand, he basically saves Judaism. If there's no Rochman ben Zakkai today, no, there would be none of us. On the other hand, he abandons all his colleagues, all his people, all his family, and lets Jerusalem be destroyed. Now, maybe he couldn't have done anything about that, but this is depends on how you look at it. You know, in the Orthodox world, he's a great sage. In the non-Orthodox world, he's more of a in-between figure.
The story so far seems to imply that he could have done a lot more.
Had he done it earlier. That's what I'm saying.
This is Orthodox lore.
This is Jewish lore.
Right. No, but when you're saying in the Orthodox world he's a good guy.
Right.
But this is Orthodox material.
No, it's Talmud. It's pure Talmud. Right.
But the conservative reform movement, we don't read the Talmud and put as much stress as the Orthodox.
Right, and the Orthodox, and that's what I'm saying. The Orthodox do, and this is a document that's saying he's not such a great guy.
And this,
But that's not how they would read it. Right. They would read it as he saved the Jewish people.
Right.
Which is true.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because he saved the Torah.
You're saying they would read the same text that clearly is saying
he gave up hope on Jerusalem.
He
didn't ask for Jerusalem. He asked for Yavna. He asked for a yeshiva.
I was going to say, Michelle, but the flaw there is the word clearly. Okay. It's not so clear. To you, it's clear.
I guess, yeah.
Because you're reading it your way.
True.
Yes, but Vespasian said, ask me for something that I can give you. He said, I'm not going to spare everybody. Ask me for something I can give you.
Yeah.
So he couldn't have asked. He would have asked to spare everybody.
He could have asked, but he wouldn't have gotten it.
But then.
And he knew he wouldn't.
It's like when you rub the lamp and the genie comes out. You only get three wishes. If you can't fulfill the wish, you lose it.
But that's this paragraph. The one before was, had you come to me sooner, we wouldn't be in this mess.
Well, that's it. Yes.
So that's why he could be looked upon as a questionable figure.
Right.
Look, if there's any theme I think that runs through all of this now, it's that. Rabbinic leadership. When do you act? When do you not act? When do you stand up for things? When do you let things go? And again, as I said, the story, you could look back now at so many points and say, if they had only done this, nothing else would have happened. And earlier when I said about the blemish, if the rabbis would have just sacrificed the damn goat, again, Jerusalem would be here today. Well, it is here today, thank God.
If the rabbis had prevented... What's his name from kicking out Bar Kamsa,
right.
Yeah. Right. It wouldn't have started.
Any one of those things could have happened.
But we would have lost so many good stories.
So I want to finish up then with one other piece.
Well, maybe you should have asked for a shoemaker.
The Talmud would be half the size.
Judy just said he should have asked for a shoemaker. Then there would be no problems, no dung, no shoes, no feet.
Well, the other thing about this is they wore a sandal, which was just...
Okay, a sandal maker. Yeah, so they should have asked for a sandal maker.
I did not get in and out of it.
Hey, for what it's worth, I stepped in a pile of dung outside the general shore in Italy.
Thank you for sharing.
TMI, I have a more technical too much information.
Everything that we've just read,
right.
Is that back-to-back in the Talmud, or
yes.
They will come out of...
No, it's all in order. I did not make... I usually do intellectual honesty, where I tell you I cut and paste, but this time I did not. But here I did for this last Dakota.
You actually stated. That's why I asked the question. It actually says now we're in the Babylonian Talmud. But so everything here is all, it all just flows.
It all flows.
Yeah.
It's all from Gittin.
So in the tractate Yoma, which is about Yom Kippur, the rabbis ponder the question, why was the first temple destroyed? Because of three evils in it: idolatry, sexual immorality, and bloodshed. Now, these are... Right, the famous thing in Jewish law are you to save a life, you can violate any commandment with the exception of three: murder, sexual immorality, and idol worship. Meaning, if someone comes to me and says, kill Aaron or I will kill you, I have to let myself be killed. But if someone comes to me and says, eat pork or I will kill Aaron, I will eat the pork. That's the thing. I left it out here, but then they go into proof texts about how each one of these three things was violated in the time of the first temple, which ties specifically to an evil king who did evil things. I think it's King Menashe, I'm not sure.
Represented by the three periods.
Yes, but why was the second temple destroyed, seeing that during its time, people occupied themselves with Torah, observance of mitzvot, and practice of charity? In other words, we can't use those three reasons to justify the destruction of the Second Temple. And here is the answer. Because during the time it stood, baseless hatred, and the word in Hebrew is sinat chinam. You should all memorize that because you'll hear it over and over and over again in Jewish life. You know, why did we have rainstorms? Why did we have this particular political leader etc. It's because we're all hating each other. This is to teach you that baseless hatred is deemed as grave as all the three sins together. And that's a lot. So it's really bad to hate fellow Jews, and by extension, fellow everyone.
Well, that's a valid reason. That's okay.
My only